China is the biggest market for EV, electric vehicles. That electricity needs to come from somewhere.
China's obstacles to reducing coal consumption. It's Wednesday, April 28th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're online. VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube are the places to visit. Also ahead, a spreading virus vaccine. Australia Indigenous Justice. Police on the defensive. Ghost kitchens. And robots create art. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Climate change has become more of a priority among top leaders in the world as emission gases are heating the planet, and one of the main contributors is the burning of coal. It's huge in Asia, and making a switch to other energy sources is not simple. China accounts for nearly 52% of the world's coal use. To find out more about China's coal consumption, VOA's Adriana Jung spoke with Jay Nakano, a senior fellow in the Energy Security and Climate Change Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Her research includes U.S. energy policy and global energy use. Today we present part two of their conversation as China deals with a disconnect between urban and rural coal use.
The central government has the political power to override the provincial government's decisions, building new plants. Some other people say that China's coal plants are already not being used at the capacity. So do you think building new plants is still the obstacle for China to reach its goal?
Great question, because yes, the utilization rates of these coal-fired power plants have been coming down. That's my understanding. But this is slightly out of date. I think until, up to 2020, 2020 was a unique year. So it's, I actually don't know exactly how, I haven't seen the data on the coal-fired power plant utilization rates for last year, but yes, utilization rates have been coming down. So even if they keep building, it wouldn't necessarily translate into higher level of a coal combustion to generate electricity. At the same time, though, I think it's still the reality that it's still being consumed. Also, tying back to the earlier part of your, the second question, China is a big country. Yes, there is, the central government, dispenses, central government, provides, directions and orders and et cetera. But I think in some of the provinces, the coal really is a much, bigger part of the local economy. I mean, coal generally is much closely tied to the state-owned enterprises or much more public sector compared to, a couple other sectors. So starting with coal mining to coal combustion for power generation, even, making some of the coal-fired power plant equipment, many of these capacities are more of a state-owned, whether it's the national level or provincial level, related to the government authority as opposed to much more of a sort of business-led, the private capital-led operations. So I think there's a big sort of a socioeconomic factor or factors that have to go in to the way in which the central government may be able to control what happens in at the provincial government levels. And it probably is something, that also varies from, the type of relationship that perhaps, the top of provinces have with the central leadership in Beijing.
The China National Coal Association said last month that China's coal consumption is expected to continue rising in 2021. So doesn't that contradict the goal?
I actually haven't seen that announcement. So it's but if that were indeed the case, it might be in contradiction to some of the peak consumption we've seen reported by some of the non-Chinese sources as well. I think one area to watch is that you know, as certainly in OECD economies, but in some of these, you know, more of the emerging economies, you know, in some of the industries, you know, there is stronger push for electrification. For example, China is the biggest market for EV, electric vehicles. You know, that electricity needs to come from somewhere. So, you know, in that sense, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that as, you know, this energy transition goes underway, that, the coal will, you know, start losing immediate appeal to, the Chinese policymakers, because of its, you know, general abundance. And to some extent, you know, it's, you know, of course, the environmental consideration has become quite serious. It's a major agenda for the Chinese government.
Jay Nakano is a senior fellow in the Energy Security and Climate Change Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She spoke with VOA's Adriana Chong. Join VOA Asia tomorrow as the conversation concludes. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Indian capital's grim battle with second virus wave wreaks havoc across city. Myanmar rebels claim to have captured army base near Thai border. Myanmar's anti-junta protesters turning to rebel armies for military training. China urges Australia not to abandon support for Taiwan reunification. More U.S. firepower ready as Afghanistan withdrawal gets underway. You'll find these stories and much more expanded with videos and photos at Facebook at VOA Asia and on our voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson. There's more VOA Asia right now. Touting the 200 million COVID-19 shots administered since he took office, President Joe Biden said he is looking into sending excess doses abroad. His administration is under pressure to do more to improve global vaccine equity, including supporting a campaign to waive vaccine patents. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Swara has the story.
Around 214 million doses of coronavirus vaccines have been given in the United States, including 200 million since President Joe Biden took office. He wants to push the number further by announcing a tax incentive for businesses providing vaccine-related paid leave to their employees. On the global front, Biden said he is trying to do more.
We're looking at what is going to be done with some of the vaccines that we are not using. We got to make sure they are safe to be sent, and we hope to be able to be of some help and value to countries around the world.
Last week, 10 Democratic senators urged Biden to support the temporary waiver of TRIPS, trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, proposed by India and South Africa at the World Trade Organization last October. More than 80 WTO members support waiving patents, which would allow countries to make generic versions of the vaccine, but not the European Union or the United States. The White House won't say why.
We're certainly looking at a range of options to help address the global pandemic, but I don't have anything more from here.
The Biden administration is under pressure from pharmaceutical companies who say that patent protection is key to tackling new variants and scaling up production to meet global needs. But in light of aggressive Chinese and Russian vaccine diplomacy, there is a geopolitical cost for Biden not to agree to waive patents.
Right now, the United States is being looked at by countries around the world as a hoarder who is buying up all the vaccine doses that are available and not sharing the technology to enable countries to make their own. In fact, especially middle-income countries aren't asking for shared doses. They're asking for the know-how so that they can make the vaccines for their own populations. And it looks incredibly stingy for the United States to say no.
The U.S. has already contributed $4 billion through COVAX, the UN vaccine sharing mechanism, and launched an initiative with other Quad countries, India, Australia, and Japan, to ramp up vaccines for Southeast Asian countries. But the World Health Organization says there remains a shocking imbalance in global vaccine distribution.
On average, in high-income countries, almost one in four people has received a vaccine. in low-income countries, it's one in more than 500. Let me repeat that. One in four versus one in 500.
As infections continue worldwide, a recap of country data shows only about 930 million vaccine doses have been administered, about 12 shots for every 100 people. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, the United States is pledging to send oxygen to India as soon as possible, and tens of millions of vaccine doses abroad in stages in response to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. India reported more than 320,000 COVID-19 cases Tuesday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. It's a pleasure to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Australian activists are hoping the George Floyd murder conviction in the United States will prompt action to cut the number of Indigenous deaths in police custody. At least 450 First Australians have died in detention since a powerful Royal Commission investigated the problem back in 1991. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
We can't breathe! On our necks.
A murder 14,000 kilometres away in the United States prompted protests last year in Australia. George Floyd's death highlighted the mistreatment of Indigenous people within the justice system. Australia's original inhabitants have been incarcerated at 13 times the rate of non-Aboriginal people. They have a greater risk of dying in custody than other prisoners. Ronnie Gorey, a former police officer, is optimistic that change is on its way.
It took the death of a black man, George Floyd, for Australia to stand up and listen and pay attention. And what they don't realise is these deaths that has been occurring in our country for centuries.
In 1991, a royal commission looking into Aboriginal deaths in custody made more than 300 recommendations across broad areas of policy, including improving the way First Nation communities interacted with the police and courts. A review in 2018 for the Prime Minister's Department in Canberra found that more than 90% of the Commission's recommendations had been fully or partly implemented. Since then, though, at least 450 Indigenous prisoners have died in custody. Tony McAvoy, who was Australia's first Indigenous senior counsel or senior barrister, says Indigenous communities simply don't trust the legal system.
We have to ask, are there things occurring and in which there are police cover-ups? They have no faith that the system is being truthful in how it's dealing with our interactions with the legal system and in particular deaths in custody.
Later this year, two serving Australian police officers will face trials for murder over the deaths of Aboriginal prisoners. They both deny the charges. Indigenous Australians are among the most incarcerated people in the world. They make up about 3% of the national population and suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, ill health and unemployment. Australia's federal, state and territory governments have joined the National Closing the Gap program that aims to improve education, employment and well-being in Indigenous communities. A key aim of the plan is to reduce the number of Aboriginal children in detention by 30% by 2031. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
After you listen to VOA Asia, you can see VOA Asia. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free. See us often at VOA Asia YouTube.
The latest news from VOA Asia. Members of the ethnic Karen guerrillas captured and burned down Myanmar Army base early Tuesday, according to a Karen official. Karen rebel forces have engaged in intense fighting against the Myanmar Army since it overthrew the democratically elected civilian government February 1st. You'll find this and all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, the guilty verdict against former police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd marks a rare conviction against a police officer for actions while on duty. As VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports, some legal experts say the case may mark a change in how courts and prosecutors deal with allegations of police misconduct.
Joy and relief on the streets of Minneapolis, where George Floyd died last year. Jurors found Floyd, an African-American, died from excessive force at the hands of former officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted Tuesday of second and third degree murder and manslaughter. The deadly confrontation, which was recorded on video, sparked protests around the world.
So many people viewed what happened, and we also, I think, have heard loud and clear the voices of impacted black and brown communities about the nature of policing in the United States, and I think all of that came together in this verdict.
The evidence was overwhelming, says another law professor.
It's so clearly not what police are trained to do, and it's caught on tape. So yes, this is very, very unusual. To have somebody actually convicted and to be convicted of murder is even more unusual.
In a 2015 case with parallels to this one, a white officer is seen on video shooting a black man, Walter Scott, in the back. The former officer was not convicted of murder after a hung jury led to a mistrial. But he was later sentenced to 20 years in prison after he pled guilty to federal charges of violating Scott's civil rights. One factor for the lack of convictions is that prosecutors often have a close working relationship with police, says legal analyst Michelle Goodwin.
Prosecutors may be reluctant then to issue charges against police officers or may not act as zealously in those trials. Take note that in Derek Chauvin's trial, it was not handled as these matters typically are by local prosecutors. Instead, this was turned over to the Attorney General.
Another difference in the George Floyd case was the crumbling of the so-called blue wall of silence as a series of police officers testified against Chauvin. Do you believe
that occurred? And I think that's huge. If that continues to happen, the culture of policing will change.
These experts say residents of inner city communities are over-policed, resulting in too many tragedies.
Yet the police are not equipped to deal with most of the problems that these folks in these communities face. And so we need to reimagine policing and rethink it and frankly transform it.
Social change has only come after people speak out, says another analyst.
And demanding and marching and boycotting buses in Montgomery, and marching on Washington, and doing all manner of resistance to inequality that demands action.
The day the Minneapolis verdicts were announced, another police shooting in Columbus, Ohio. An officer killed a teenage girl who was seen on video wielding a knife. Critics say police need to follow clear, consistent rules for the use of force across the country. Police say their job is dangerous and that they're asked to do too much without necessary resources, sometimes facing distraught people who need psychiatric help. Amid calls for changes in policing, in Minneapolis there is relief that the judicial system has delivered a measure of justice. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, in Afghanistan, seven people were killed, more than 70 injured, when two buses crashed head-on in a traffic accident on a highway late Monday near Kabul. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, since the pandemic began, many Americans have gotten more used to making their own meals at home. But that doesn't mean people don't want a great restaurant meal from time to time. Karen Berfigian orders out.
You won't see any waiters coming into this restaurant kitchen to grab orders. The food here is made only for pickup and delivery from a place called a ghost kitchen.
We found this location. It was a third-generation restaurant that had been, in existence. And we said, you know, this is a perfect space for us. So we said, look, we love this space. It's too big for us. So we said, well, hey, what if we invited some of our friends to join us?
Valerie and her cousin Taryn cook a myriad of chicken soups for their customers, about 100 orders a day. They share the kitchen with two other cafes that work just like them, with a donut shop and a cafe that makes believing pies.
I'm very thankful for this place. It helped me tremendously because I wouldn't be able to open up my delivery platform to other places if I wasn't able to share the space here.
Just like regular restaurants, ghost kitchens fight for patrons. They need good ratings and reviews, and like all other food venues, they need to get all the necessary licenses and fulfill the sanitary norms and requirements. Theodore Sample, together with restaurateur Alan Popovsky, recently opened a virtual restaurant that used to be a pizza place.
Well, I will give credit to our owner, Alan Popovsky, who decided, that during these tough times, we're trying to create ideas to keep our business surviving through the epidemic, of course, or the pandemic.
Opening a traditional restaurant in a trendy D.C. neighborhood can cost anywhere from $100,000 to $1 million. A ghost kitchen business can be as affordable as a few thousand dollars. There is no need for table space or waiters. But Sample says he misses the personal touch.
I hope it doesn't just go to this. We do need to have human communication. We need to sit, relax, escape. But I think the world has changed, and we have to this is a part of the business that is going to be with us for a while.
All of the owners here say nothing can replace a dinner out face-to-face with a group of friends. But until the world opens back up, and maybe even beyond, ghost kitchens will be offering a taste of dining out delivered to your door. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
Old machines are transformed into new robots in an exhibition that makes viewers think twice about the machines they use. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
Take a step into this art gallery and you'll notice objects that are vaguely familiar.
This is a complete vacuum cleaner.
These robots are the creations of Argentine artist Christian Castro.
Vegetable steamer.
In this art exhibit called Robotics Intersections of Art and Technology, Castro's robots are made up of objects such as appliances from the 50s and 60s and parts from old planes and cars.
I find parts everywhere. I go to the aircraft graveyards. I go to the cars graveyards.
This giant crab-like robot. Its body is actually the rear door of a Volkswagen Beetle, and the eyes are garden lights. Castro is one of hundreds of artists from more than 34 countries who have shown their work in this space in Santa Monica, California, hosted by Building Bridges Art Exchange, an organization that creates cultural understanding through the arts. In his work, Castro challenges the audience to look at form as well as function of a machine through these robots.
The artist points at the neglected virtues of technology, such as the appreciation of beauty.
Machines are often valued for their function, but not what they look like. Castro finds old mechanical objects, such as vacuum cleaners, and removes them from their original function. The focus becomes no longer what they can do, but the beauty of their form. In the process, a new creation is born, giving old objects new life and purpose.
When I saw a piece or part from a helicopter or for old appliance, I seen a character around this part.
Nowadays, it seems that the designs are more plain. All the toasters look the same. While when you look at when you look back in time, designs were more prominent. They were more sophisticated, perhaps.
Castro says he hopes anyone who sees his robots will be inspired to recycle and look at everyday machines in a different light. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
It's been so nice to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks for stopping by. Join us again tomorrow at the same time. And in the meantime, you'll find us online, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. We also thank our team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead. Be safe. Be well.